This is session number 35. It's being recorded on April 2nd, 2007, and side one. And we're continuing with the preface of Arthur Croker and David Cook's book, The Postmodern Scene. And the subtitle of that book, I don't know if I said that much, is Excremental Culture and Hyperaesthetics. Excremental, you know, like shit.
Mm-hmm.
Excremental Culture and Hyperaesthetics is the subject of the Postmodern Scene. And we've been working through the prefatory introduction, and it's Roman numerals, page 2 to 7. And we're doing various panic categories, and right now we're doing panic noise, continuing from session 34. So we're doing a quote. I'm going to read this quote, which we half did at the end of side 2 of the previous session, and then we'll continue, okay?
All right.
Says, similarly, the socialist mass vanishes now into the fictive world of the media of hypercommunication, caught only by all the violent signs of mobility and permeability. The social is already only the afterglow of the disappearance of the famous reality. The world may have lost its message and all the grand receipts in italics, they being money, sex, the unconscious. So, reading that again, this world may have lost its message, and all the grand receipts, power, money, sex, the unconscious, may also be abandoned, except as recycled signs in the frenzied world of the social catalyst. But what is finally fascinating is only the socialist burnout in italics. The world of Hobbes has come full circle when the postmodern self is reproduced as a vibrating set of particles, and when the social is seductive only on its negative side, the dark side of sumptuary excess and decline. So my statement that everything's disappeared is well supported here, right?
Well, but this seems to be sort of an after image that is hanging around as a specter, right, as in ghost or whatever.
Yeah.
But so it's, or VR, I mean, literally when everything's disappeared, there's nothing at all to see. There's not even an after image.
Right. I do talk about the virtual reality or the Android meme of the 90s. In the 90s, we have the after image of the Android meme.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm talking about after image, and Croker is talking about after image. Earlier quotes, he actually used the word, but similar stuff here to what I was saying in the late 80s, early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, when Arthur Croker heard Bob's Mediacology, he told me, he goes, these guys are doing the same thing we're doing.
Oh.
And he was putting out CDs at the time, too.
Yeah, Spasm was pretty good.
Yeah. So we got to burnout.
What year was this written again?
1986.
Okay, so this is still Android meme phase.
That's why on my chart, I have Croker as the best describer of the Android meme, building on and going beyond Baudrillard.
Mm-hmm.
Because my quadrant on the chart is after the Android meme. That's right, it's interesting, the album comes out in 92, Nelson and them, they had perfect timing because we had moved into the Bob Zone, which starts after 1990.
Mm-hmm. And Croker's the mythic government.
Yeah. And I'm locked down Dobstown.
Yeah.
Which is expressed by Cold Fusion.
Mm-hmm.
Brought about by Cold Fusion. So the world of Hobbes has come full circle when the self, but he has in brackets the postmodern self, is endlessly reproduced as a vibrating set of particles. Now, you know, in my chart, I have different subatomic particle names for each quadrant. So each quadrant is a quark particle.
Mm-hmm.
Subatomic particle. And so Croker's already discussing our after-image world like that. And when the social is seductive only on its negative side. So you had the positive side in the 50s and 60s. And then in the flip point, people were fascinated by the burnout in the negative side, what McLuhan called the rise and fall of cliches.
Mm-hmm.
So the dark side, the negative side, he doesn't mean the dark side in the Jungian sense of yin-yang. Though most people talk about the dark side, it became a popular cliche in the 80s and 90s, and they were thinking of it in terms of new yin-yang or Jungian complementariness, or made up of both sides, positive and negative. But the dark side, they don't think of the dark side process, not a psychological character, but a process, environmental excess, abuse, waste, and disaccumulation, or sumptuary excess and decline. And because it's an after image of it, we are fascinated by it, because it's already been wiped out. So we're fascinated knowing that everybody's going to, at best, replay themselves as a sign, a recycled sign, on the negative side, on the dark side. So
what
AIDS,
does that look like?
Beg your pardon?
AIDS?
AIDS would be one example. Like, think of power, money, sex, and the unconscious power. White House Reagan. That seemed to be a disgusting image for a lot of people around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Money had crashed in the 80s, and then you had junk bonds reinvigorated the afterimage of money, and then sex was AIDS, and the unconscious was rampant going around, Jay-Z Knight channeling the Atlantean warrior ramp stuff, 35,000-year-old warrior, or Shirley MacLaine doing TV shows on the occult.
Whatever happened to AIDS? It seemed like it appeared they were saying that it was epidemic in the 80s, and now I don't even hear about it.
Well, the point was that many decades ago that AIDS was a genetically engineered virus, and it had a debilitating effect, but the virus had a life cycle of 29 years. So by 2009, it's going to be like a 24-hour flu.
Oh.
Now, they never figured out what AIDS is, and more and more scientists are saying it ain't what we thought it was, and there's a lot of confusion. And a lot of people now are saying, yeah, there's lots of devastation in Africa, and it's caused by AIDS, but there's many people, doctors or people working in clinics, they say, no, it's not AIDS. There's no such thing as a virus. It's AIDS virus. It's poverty and malnutrition and all that stuff. It's going to get really good. People will, by 2012, believe there is no, never was an AIDS. It's so weak. But there was a virus. It was very virulent in the first 10 years. So that confusion is going to, it would be clarified by me, but who's going to listen to me? We'll get people like Gary Null doing documentaries right now saying that AIDS is not a virus, never was. And yeah, he has interviews with hundreds of doctors and scientists agreeing with him.
Mm-hmm.
But AIDS is a great metaphor for the Android meme. Very hard to understand the Android meme. Very hard to understand the AIDS virus.
Mm-hmm. Well, he begins this paragraph saying, similarly, the social as mass vanishes now into the fictive world of media, of the media of hyper-communication. So when he says the social as mass, what social is he talking about? Is that people going out to cafes in Paris, or what social is it that actually disappeared?
Well, the social, in my terms, would be the chemical body in a group formation, whatever the group is, cities, demonstrations, going to work, and you could call that the mass man. But if you bring in McLuhan, the social as mass would be a discarded image, and that would be the TV world, the TV landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So either way, the TV landscape or the common community of the 19th century sociologists called the social has disappeared,
mm-hmm.
superseded by the chip economy. And so the social as mass, either in traditional sociological terms, or Marxist terms, or McLuhan terms, vanishes now into the fictive world of the media of hypercommunication. So it would seem if it's disappearing into the fictive world of the media, that would be into the landscape. And it's hyper because it's panicking and soundbite world by the 80s because it's being spun by the hidden ground of the chip landscape.
Mm-hmm.
So the socialist mass vanishes now into the fictive world of the media of hypercommunication. The use of mass here must mean the chemical body, sociological grouping of humans, because it's disappearing, in my terms, into the TV body. or into the TV landscape, so that the TV landscape is not what he means by mass there.
Mm. Well, let's see, you have computer satellite. Its nodal point is 1970.
Right.
So we're actually kind of past the chip body now. The nodal point 1980, you have satellite squared.
Right.
Well, it seems like you associate the computer with Croker, but you don't have...
No. The Croker, the computer phase, that's when there was reel-to-reel, reel tapes. It's not the digital computer. The digital doesn't get sprung on people until the personal computer, say, 1984.
Uh-huh.
Right? And then really doesn't get going until Netscape in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at the chart, you have to relate it to the dates underneath it. Remember, it's 1918 to 1945. That's the computer phase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the invention of computers, mainframe computers. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Cathode tubes and tapes. And then what they start to put in the semiconductors, or the integrated circuit.
Right.
Okay, that's the era of big computers. As the computers get digitalized and get compressed and become miniaturized, the human begins to seem bigger than the computers. They couldn't believe that the big, massive, room-occupying computers were now in a little computer in their home in 1985
mm-hmm.
as a word processor. That is the satellite effect, because the satellite goes around all the previous media. So the liberation from big media environments, in my system, is the satellite effect.
Mm-hmm.
So each phase of the chart is always satellite, always post radio, TV, computer, and so I call it satellite squared, as the satellite effect itself disappears or gets miniaturized.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to the anthropomorphic physical Dobbs quadrant, you are looking at tiny, tiny media. So Thompson represents the 60s and 70s computer phase. Croker represents the flood, or called the interactive flux, of the Android meme disappearing, or the computer world disappearing and making you seem on top of it, and it's interactive as well.
Mm-hmm.
The computer environment of the 1918 and 1945 period, which Thompson replays inside the Android meme satellite or solar theater satellite effect as it shrinks. The computer from 1918-1945 is a monstrous medium. It's not an interactive medium. It's a big brother kind of medium to be feared, at least back
yeah.
then. You see what I'm saying?
Well,
it's an analog medium.
Right. Well, people, I don't think the word computer was circulating between 1918 and 1945.
Oh, that's right, but remember, the chart is the effects preceding the causes. It's the hidden ground. It's the effects sneaking up on people.
Mm-hmm.
So television was worked on from the year 1900 to 1918. It's around 1918 that Philo Farnsworth starts to, as a young boy, starts to imagine and come up with ideas for the electric television. The mechanical television doesn't service until 1924. You have to look at that. The chart is showing a hidden ground. Many things in the arts and sciences are preparing for the possibility of computers
mm-hmm.
from 1918 to 1945. Yeah, computers don't really get going until the 30s, but it builds on developments 10 years before that. So that's you have to read.
Well,
what
was going on with computers in the 30s? I don't remember computers in the 30s.
You haven't heard of that book where IBM was used by the Nazis in the concentration camps to keep the victims... statistics?
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah. It's a famous book by Edward or Edmund Black.
Mm.
Wrote, I don't know, 7-8 years ago. No, Thomas Watson and IBM were starting to implement computers and check it out in the late 30s.
Wow. So basically, when we get the satellite, it's taking the global radio, TV, and computer and sort of merging them or mixing and matching them and creating the satellite tactility effect.
Yes.
And then the satellite, under the satellite tactility, that is shrinking.
Once you put that whole complex and start shrinking it digitally. The digital is the Android meme phase, where the Android meme is starting to shrink these massive environments, radio, TV, computer, and satellite, to the point, 20 years later, you got all those media in your lap. All right? So the Android meme is slowly disappearing itself, so that you feel,
yeah,
whatever you are, the anthropomorphic physical, thinks that you can edit and control these.
You mean when they combine digital with solid state? Because computers were digital in the 30s. It's just they were using vacuum tubes.
Yeah, whatever you want to call it, the development since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it started at BBN in Cambridge or MIT, a spinoff in 1960. That's when BBN, the company, started inventing stuff, and they came out of the military projects of the 50s, and many of the ARPA and DARPA stuff that the Internet eventually came out of came out of that company, BBN, which is interesting. That's BB is 22 and N is 14, N being the 14th letter in the alphabet, so you got 22-14. So that's why the chart is 1960 to 1990. That's the growth of the Android meme. And it gets tinier and tinier and tinier, whatever you want to call it.
Well, it's growing up until 80. By 90, it's become figure. It's no longer ground.
That's right. Right. And my chart is a picture of the afterimage of the Android meme. And it's done in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
So the it's showing you how these people replay.
Well, it doesn't become an afterimage until 1990.
Right.
Your chart begins in 1960, so the whole chart isn't a picture of the after image of the Android meme. The last clip of it is.
It's a picture of the Android meme in the after image phase. It's totally visible.
Oh, I see.
As figure, because it's no longer ground in the middle 90s.
Oh, I see, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's obsolete. And so I'm making an image of the ghost.
Yeah. Cool.
It's a piece of paper.
Yeah.
Until it got made on computer graphics.
Yeah.
And you can see it at fivebody.com. But,
yeah.
But
it's totally, would you say the Android meme is totally abstract and ethereal? Or just?
No, it's a physical reality.
Oh.
But it's.
So you include.
To describe it, you have to use all the factors in my chart to describe it.
Right.
You got to read, you know, LaRouche.
So it has. You
no, it follows. You got to read LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, and Croker, and me to start to see what your assumptions are and what your blinders are. Then you start looking at, oh, okay, and then it's all invisible, so subatomic particles, so you see which particles it is according to my chart.
What do you mean it's all invisible, subatomic particles?
Electricity's always been invisible. It began with the telegraph.
Right.
We only see the effects. It's just like...
That's the virtual part of the equation. It's still, there's a physicality. You still got...
Yeah.
Still got the tractors and the buildings and the physical media.
Okay, that's when you bring in Aristotle's four causes. You have the literal, you have the, formal cause, the material cause, the symbolic cause, and the final cause. Not symbolic, what are they?
Efficient?
Efficient cause, right. Efficient cause, material cause, final cause, and formal cause. Formal cause is the audience of users. The material cause would be hydro dams, hydroelectric plants, the actual stuff that goes into making the hardware, what you just call the trucks and the oil and that, to make the environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the efficient cause will be maybe the technology of distributing the electricity
mm-hmm.
that's produced by the material cause. And then the final cause is your radio. So all the parts are within those four causes, all the structure. But McLuhan emphasizes the formal cause.
Yeah.
LaRouche emphasizes the efficient cause. Thompson emphasizes the material cause. And Croker emphasizes the final cause. That's why in the Croker zone we get a lot of talk about the end of the world.
Croker's final?
Yeah.
Now, do these line up with the way that you have it laid out on Bob's Media Ecology? The four, you have the.
I don't have the chart.
Formal. You have formal causality, or in other words, the actual implementation of the communications environment.
Not the implementation. That's material and the efficient. The formal cause is the effect of the hardware on humans. and previous media. The effect on the audience, the users.
Mm-hmm.
And McLuhan maintained that formal cause was lost after the printing press. No one thought about formal cause.
Yeah.
That became the cliche in the 19th century, early 20th century of forward with progress. Damn the torpedoes. Forget the effects. It's all going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
Then by the 60s, everybody said, wait a minute, it didn't turn out so great. We forgot about the effects on us.
Mm-hmm.
So formal causality came back through McLuhan.
Right. On Bob's Mediacology, you have the first phase as being like the distribution of televisions and radios. And
Where is that on there?
It's not on the chart. It's what you say when you're being interviewed on the radio thing.
Yeah, I talk about the four causes on there, don't I?
Yeah. You say the first level is, you know, the programming of the sensory typology by distribution of televisions and radios and satellites and, you know, the hardware of communications technology. The next level you have as being programming content, advertising, you say, sort of is in the interim, it sort of takes care of itself, but you have programming the communications hardware with past environments or programming the content. Then you have the bureaucratic level, assassination, CIA, undercover, all that.
Yeah, the bureaucratic control.
Yeah, and then you have collective clairvoyance. That's how you lay it out in the radio interview on Bob's Mediacology.
I think they were not causes. They might have been the four levels of exegesis.
Mm-hmm.
The literal level, the symbolic level, the moral level, and the eschatological level. I think that. See, there's the four causes, and then there's the four levels of exegesis.
Oh, okay.
I think that's what it is on the M. Did you write this down? Are you reading
it? No, I'm just remembering it because I was listening to it while I was driving around.
Yeah, lately?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's. I think it's four levels of organizing the book of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Analyzing the text of nature.
Right.
And I was speaking as an agent for the solar government. How we looked at the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, the formal cause, we program people with media ratios. The symbolic cause, the symbolic level was advertising and information content that had symbolic folkloric meaning for people that distracted them from the formal effects,
mm-hmm.
which was the literal first level. And then the third level was applying it to human conduct and human morality, and that was the bureaucratic control of power and offing people and coups and all that stuff
mm-hmm.
that people think of as CIA or Big Brother work.
Right.
That's implementing the what's called the tropological level, or the level applied to human standards,
mm-hmm.
human values and ethics and power hierarchies. And then the final cause is the eschatological, grabbing for mysteries or grabbing for straws and winging it. That was led to Bob's anachrony and complex clairvoyance.
Yeah.
And so I ran the Secret Council 10 in the late 80s through the eschatological level, because we've been at quite far along in the evolution of the solar government's methods.
Right.
So I ended up managing things by having a TV series project me.
Right. What TV series?
Well, Twin Peaks was a major one.
Oh, yeah.
But there was lots of other little ones in the 80s.
Right.
Here and there would pop up. But I surfaced, since my zone was over by 1990, and then I would become Figure in the 90s. That's why you had Twin Peaks in 1990, the movie Wild at Heart, and what was the other? And the Twin Peaks movie Fire Walk With Me. And then you had all those movies of the last 10 years have Bob stuff in them.
Yeah.
Like The Matrix.
Well, you say the Android meme becomes Figure in 1990, and then you say you become Figure in 1990. I mean,
The Android meme after image is Figure.
Oh.
Okay, the Android meme is Figure or after image in the 90s. The Android meme has been using me as a standard, and so I'm in the media more and more in the 90s. As part of the hidden history of the Android meme from 60 to 90.
Yeah.
You follow that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not me. It's the after image of me.
How is it...
And that's complex clairvoyance was one term I came up with to describe that strange process.
Mm-hmm. How is it noticing you?
Well, my theory is that it needs to know what people want so that it can make them feel that it ain't bothering them. It's giving them the power.
Uh-huh.
And to figure out what the mass mind is, they had to have a standard. They'd say, well, what's the smartest mind? What's the dumbest mind? And we'll look for a happy medium. And so I think they tuned into my perception of things as a standard of someone who knew what really was going on and used that as a standard and then dumbed down from there or watered it down.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll have direct references in me in such things as SpongeBob or The Matrix. And even Baudrillard, who inspired the Wachowski brothers in thinking out The Matrix, when they asked him after the first movie became a big success and they were going to make some more movies, they asked him to consult with them on it. He refused because he said, you guys have no clue what I'm talking about. So it's not that The Matrix is an intelligent movie.
Mm-hmm.
It is symptomatic for the mass mind of actual Bob stuff, which nobody understands, but the understandable translation of Bob, dumbed down in quotes, is The Matrix series.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, many people didn't even like that series, the second and third movie. It failed, you know.
Yeah.
And because they really didn't know how to make it better. And you're always going to fail when you deal with the average, happy average.
Cause yeah.
And especially in the blogosphere or just people having access to media to express their opinion, you're getting a lot of dissenting opinions going on since the middle 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody sees the cliche TV landscape as something easily to beat up. So if you approximate any of the old-fashioned media, you're going to get beat up by millions of bloggers.
Yeah.
Or emailers.
Right.
So, David Lynch is pretty good, but not perfect, you know.
Yeah.
I'm perfect. I'm the guy who says exactly what's going on, but I dare you, I challenge you to understand me. You'd have to be perfect, too. I don't mean perfect in morality, but perfect in perception of what's going on.
Yeah. And so then the sort of the eternal question is,
I'm the only one alive as the... today, April 2nd, we're celebrating the fact that the paranoia issue is on the stands right now.
Right. But then, you know, is the android meme alive? That's the other big question.
It makes itself seem alive by accommodating you. It doesn't get in your way. Like life, the life force in yourself, you can't know it. Where is it?
Yeah.
You just feel it. Well, the android meme, it makes itself invisible like the life force, and you feel the ecstatic effects of your hyper-communication. And the only thing, that doesn't mean it's alive. It's just the effect it creates, and people are within that, but if they don't know that, they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
At least in the realm of communication, they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
See, I spend a lot of my time communicating with what's going on, and you don't hear it. But it's going on in the complex clairvoyance of me acting out my life. What I do.
Mm.
It's multi-sensory, multi-gestural. So I don't need to show up in the media.
You
hear the sense? I don't need to show up in the media every day.
Yeah. Well, if you're just taking a walk around Central Park, are you having effects?
Yeah. For example, I finally got to see Borat. Did you ever see that movie?
Yeah.
I just saw it this weekend. Somebody sent it over, and it came out last fall, I think. You know, 6 months ago. Yeah, because it was a big hit at the Toronto Film Festival, and that was in September. So, last fall, 6 months ago. Here it is 6 months, and I watch it this weekend, and it totally anticipates my trip coming up, if the trip happens.
Hmm.
And I didn't know I was going to do that trip 2 months ago, but the trip appeared possible over the last few weeks. Then I see the movie Borat, and the movie gives the details of some parts of my trip right in front of me.
Mm.
Now, that's complex clairvoyance.
Yeah.
How the heck does that happen? I mean, and the movie was made a year ago.
Yeah.
But it had perfect timing for me to interact with it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm glad I didn't see it till now.
That's weird.
That is weird. Isn't that fucking weird?
No, but I was just going to say that in my own experience, I have occasionally, I have precognition. I'm not always aware of it, but I'll have, when things in my life, events, things come about, I'll realize that I was already aware that that was coming in. It was affecting me before it happened. And but I don't.
You were aware. It affected you before it happened, and you were aware when.
When the event occurred, I would say, oh, I've been feeling this coming on for, you know, this has been affecting me for 3 days now, and it just happened. Or I'll see.
Okay, now you could say that's what happened to me, but the point is, it happened to me around a media product, which was a big sensation.
Right. Yeah, that's.
Yeah, you're talking about something. People get what you're talking about.
Personal subjectivity, synchronicities
all the time.
But with you, it's reflected in the media images.
Yeah, like I saw Munich a few months ago. You ever see Munich?
Yeah.
And there's a total, the main people in it. People told me that Munich had me in it. So I didn't know what it was about, and I saw it. And, there's a René character. My father and me in there.
Oh.
In France.
Hmm.
And it's 1972, and now what's interesting is that Carol and I were in Munich the day that that happened.
Wow.
Did they ever tell you that?
No.
Yeah, we were, we arrived in Munich, and the Olympics were happening, so we wanted to go see the Olympics. So we grabbed some public transport and went over to the place where the games were being held, and there were all these tanks. And I remember saying to Kim, man, the security here is ridiculous. You know, what's this for? So we go in there, we're walking around, and there's people looking at different events, and there's, you know, booths for people to buy food or things. And then we looked over on the edge of a cliff, there was all these people lined up staring out into nothing. So we walked over and said, what the heck are the people looking at? And they were on the edge of, some landscape of game auditoriums and open fields, and they're looking across. It turned out to be the domestic headquarters, the residences for the athletes. And so they were watching the terrorists. They had come out in the news, I guess. We weren't listening to news that day. Come out in the news that there was been a hijacking in the Israeli, wherever the Israeli athletes were staying. And if you look in the news events, it's even in the movie, you see the hijackers come out on the balcony of this little apartment building. So everybody was looking at the apartment building. And yet we were looking at it. I don't think we found out. We didn't ask. Just, what are they looking at? But we kind of ignored it and went around and looked at some of the games. And that. And then when we were downtown, we met with a friend, and a friend told us. Did you see the news? We said, no, what happened? They told us.
Mm.
I mean, I just thought, I didn't know why they were looking at the residence.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Just everybody's looking at it, so tourists or whatever, what the heck? Maybe there's something going on over there. But I was interested in seeing whatever I wanted to see, so we went and saw stuff. Then about 4 hours later, we're downtown in Munich, and the friend shows up, and he said, did you hear the news? I said, what? Said the hijacked athletes in the residence at the games.
Hmm.
So then we understood why there was tanks and everything.
Hmm.
But I walked around thinking, man, what this security is... It's ridiculous, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the whole crisis has started maybe 5 hours before we got there.
Mm.
And so everything had gone into emergency mode.
Mm-hmm.
So here's this thing, and then 35 years later, I see a movie about it, and it's got me in there. And that's in 72 when I am working for René and his boss.
Mm.
You know, I'm just an underling at that point.
Yeah. So, you ever get creeped out like you're being overshadowed by something that's bigger than...
Well, if you read up the Orfeanti, I talk about the first time I became aware of this odd phenomenon in 1954 when I found the book was the reason McLuhan was able to write that first article and expose what we in the Secret Council of Ten used. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the tetradic process. So I had that built up through the decades. And so I was quite used to it by the 80s.
Mm.
And I hadn't figured out, I can't say fully why it's happening.
Mm.
But by the 90s, as it just got so obvious, I came up with a theory.
Well, given the fact that you always have a pretty healthy, happy disposition towards life, well, I'd have to say whatever it is not malevolent. It doesn't seem to be threatening or bugging you too much.
No, not me. But that's why I say I'm the only one alive. Meanwhile, everybody else is in hell,
mm-hmm.
in many levels.
Mm.
Yeah, that's why I say I celebrated the triumph of the Android meme. Now, I don't know if I've said it on this series, but the point of my public message is that the Android meme will make it seem that you are experiencing synchrony more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm the canary in the mine who survived.
Mm.
I'm the one who was played with first, figured a yoga in relation to it.
You know,
figured out some kind of yogic relationship to it, and that is the good message. I say you can too, if you understand. It takes a while to understand it. What is going to come to you?
Yeah.
Because the Matrix does show people in pods where they think they're living in New York City or someplace, right?
Right.
It's all geared. The imagery is all geared around your supposed life, but it's a dream.
Yeah.
So metaphorically, the niche marketing of the Android meme since the 80s has been more and more targeting people to their lifestyle and what their preferences and their little bubble, and then meeting it, and they live in it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's like lifestyle. Pretty soon it's going to be, you're going to have Scott look at news about Scott.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that seems like a direction in the direction of... The friction disappearing, actually.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Fragmentation.
That's a software version of frictionless tyranny.
See, now, are we moving into a new unity or a new fragmentation?
Well, it's those terms are too simple or leaden. We've already been unified since the telegraph. Inside the electric membrane,
yeah.
but the media environments.
But it also fragmented us. I mean, I'm thinking of
Wait, that's all. It unified people with the telegraph, the telephone, the movie, the radio, and the television. Then the and the computer. Then the satellite allowed you to get out of that and begin to fragment.
Mm-hmm.
At least that was the effect of it. Then the digitization shrinks that satellite autonomy. And more gives you what you want when you want it. And in relation to the social, the common shared chemical body space that most of history has been, that is, from that perspective, we've become atomized and fragmented. You see what I'm saying? We're all in a little dream world.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, we've been more and more, it's moved toward the unified, which is what I call the cloning of ESP. And then the voluntary ESP is the digital phase. Cloning ESP is analog, TV and radio, computer satellite. Then the replay by the Android meme in the digital form atomizes, and you don't have to be a victim of the cloned ESP. You're inside a voluntary ESP, and you can disconnect from the social, which could be called a meme or a kind of public ESP, that a culture has. We tried to figure out what meme meant, you know, many sessions ago, right?
Right.
So the social is like the meme.
Mm.
And now you don't have to merge with the social mass meme.
Mm-hmm.
You can create your own little fantasy world.
Right.
So that is more fragmentation. So both processes were sneaking up on us, the unification and the fragmentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the United Nations had the phrase, you know, for 25 years now, I guess, unity in diversity or diversity in unity.
Mm-hmm.
Think globally, act locally.
Right.
There's unity and fragmentation at the same time.
Right. But is it is it centralizing and decentralizing? It's actually
Yeah. Cohen wrote about that. Centralizing and decentralizing at the same time.
Is it? Okay. Because Gutenberg centralized.
Yeah, and electric media, analog media decentralized.
Right.
So we've been centralizing and decentralizing in the analog clone DSP phase. But it's gotten, those terms are too wide. Now it's subatomic vibrating particles, as Croker said, the part we just read.
Mm-hmm.
We're subatomic particles living our own little string theory dreams.
Hmm.
So it's not in terms of chemical body social anymore. So even though we're talking about me the last 20 minutes and my charts and all that, it does relate to the quote we're talking about. And the quote is, what's it mean the socialist mass has disappeared into the fictive media of hypercommunication? Well, we've been explaining that just the last 10 minutes.
The social is already only the afterglow of the disappearance of the famous reality principle.
Yeah.
That's the most convoluted thing I ever read. The reality principle, is he referring to in the sense that Freud talked about pleasure-seeking activity of the id in order to meet the demands of the external world?
Yeah, I think so. Like I said in previous session, number 34, we're re-listening to a bit of it before we started this session, and to remind us what we said, and that was discussed at the very end, and I said it was the Newtonian gravity principle. But as I heard that, I was thinking, I think technically it's from Freud, but from Newton to Freud, you're dealing with the chemical body. And so, yeah, it can be applied, in my meaning here, to both what Freud's talking about, the unconscious, and the and Newton's gravity for the chemical body.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reality principle, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's been no reality since the 20s and 30s, once we had the radio environment. That's when physicists were forced to go to the invisible.
Mm.
And if you weren't inclined to understand that, you thought that physics went nuts. It had abandoned the reality principle. And it's interesting, LaRouche critiques the subatomic quantum thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
LaRouche falls back on a kind of reality principle. But his principle is pretty ephemeral, too, because it's Platonic and not knee-jerk neoconservatism.
Right. Well, Platonic,
right?
Yeah.
That?
Platonic is logocentric.
What is it?
Logocentric. It's the idea that you have a single voice, the voice of Christ, basically.
It's the voice of what?
Well, Christ in LaRouche's
case. Right, but
listen
to this. What's interesting, when you read LaRouche, and we're going to get back to LaRouche, he is trying not to be logocentric. That's what's interesting. Even though for most other people in other quadrants, he looks logocentric.
Yeah, well, Plato was logocentric.
Well, that's because they turned, as McLuhan said, speech, or the oral form, into art form.
Yeah.
They were...
Well, they thought they could arrive at a fundamental truth that would underlie the powers of reason. The powers of reason and language reflected, like the word of God or something. And
right, now just follow that. Applying McLuhan, when he says that brilliant statement that the Greek culture turns the previous oral culture, and the Greek culture is starting to be visual space, they turn the previous environment into an art form. So they took the speech environment of oral culture through the effect of the hidden ground of visual space, and therefore came up with a logocentric version of speech, of the speech culture.
Mm-hmm.
But the speech world that actually was well before Plato was not logocentric, it was multisensuous. It was, like McLuhan says, language was tactile.
Oh, yeah.
But visual space made people think of language as verbal and not tactile. And it's filtered through the process of a new environment turns the old one into an art form, or the old environment contains a repository of aesthetic or spiritual values. So they were putting, like you said, all this archetypal spiritual value in reason or speech,
mm-hmm.
which was a visually constricted form compared to the multisensuous tactile language of primitive cultures. You follow what I'm saying? It's probably pretty hard to get. But
yeah. But, with Socrates and Plato, it was still pretty multi-sensuous. I mean...
when you read LaRouche, he brings the multi-sensuous back into it.
Mm-hmm.
But But because he...
It doesn't really lose its multi-sensuous until all the cascading effects that proceed after Aristotle.
Yeah, Aristotle is starting to make it logocentric.
Yeah.
Right? He gets into classic...
Well, no, I think it's logocentric with Plato, because Plato and...
Yeah, but Aristotle comes...
And Socrates is universal truth, and that they're able to speak it.
Well, Aristotle is Plato. Plato's a student of Socrates. So all three of them are logocentric.
Yeah. It's just that with Aristotle becomes very, visual space begins to become really isolated. It becomes isolated from the sense of the soul.
But not
the idea that you have a soul is almost a logocentric notion. And Plato and Socrates believed in the soul, and that the soul, that the mouth could, speech could utter, the truth of this of the soul. But
right. Now that is not as hypervisual as when the printing press comes in. So McLuhan says the Greek culture, not the Roman culture, but the medieval culture, were more balanced, oral and visual.
Yeah.
So the Aristotle...
Well, he also liked that the medieval culture, that we didn't have typography yet, we had script.
And a lot of orality.
Yeah, and the way that the script flowed from the pen had a, individual quality. It wasn't mechanical like the printing press.
Yeah, like the...